Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Our next guest truly needs no introduction. The godfather of camp, the man who brought the gift that was divine to mainstream audiences, and is a self-described filth elder. He is a director of almost 20 films, author of 7 books, and the inspiration for generations of people wanting to get a taste of the artistic underground. His name is John Waters, and his newest book was released just yesterday. It's called Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder. And I'm very pleased that you're in the studio today. Hi, John.
Thank you for having me.
So this book is a group of essays, a little bit of advice, a little bit of storytelling about your life, your work. And I sort of suggest, it sort of suggested to me that you're telling people, go ahead, be as weird or odd as you want, as long as you're authentic about it.
And you believe in it yourself. And one other person has to believe in you besides yourself that isn't your parents. Yeah, so that is very, very important. And at first, no one will accept you. Anything that catches on that's good that lasts in the arts is hated at first. That's what happens. I built a career on negative reviews. Now, a negative review won't help me today, but it certainly did when you're starting out.
So when you first got a negative review, did you have this sort of wise feeling about it?
Or maybe was it, I did, because we put it in the ads, because there was a local Baltimore Sun reviewer that hated my film, but gave us great quotes, like, not since The Conqueror Worm has there been a worse movie, things like that. So we would always put them in the ad, and he got mad, and he said, you beat us to the typewriter by calling your films trash epics, which I did, the same way that Johnny Depp was sick of being a teen idol. Mm-hmm. He played one in my movie. Tracy Lords didn't want to be thought of as porn, so she played a bad girl. Patty Hearst didn't want to be a victim, so she made a joke on that. So if you take what they use against you and you exaggerate it and seem proud of it, it loses its power, that negative term.
Did you always know this, or was this something that you had to learn along the way?
I think I knew it some, because I got Variety since I was 14 years old, and I always knew that censorship by dumb censors helped. And later I learned that censorship by smart people, the MPAA, hurt.
You call them the enemy of true radical filmmaking.
Well, they are, because they say for the American family, well, which version of the American family? The American family has very, very much changed, and they've had the same people in power for 20 years. Now, she finally quit. And she was very nice to deal with, like a snake, you know. And it's like, that's the scary ones that are smart.
Oh, yes, of course.
The dumb ones, like the Maryland Censor Board, she used to say to me, don't tell me about sex. I was married to an Italian. What do you say to that?
You just nod and do what you want to do.
Yeah.
So as a kid, you describe yourself sort of as eccentric. What's a good story to really help us understand little John Waters?
Well, two things. Once I used to pretend I was the painting The Nude in the Staircase by Emily Duchamp because I saw it in Life magazine, but I didn't tell anybody. So I would come down the steps like trying to be surreal every morning, and my parents would look at me, what is the matter with you? And I would just think to myself, you fool, don't you know who Duchamp is? And then my mother told me this story later, that I used to come home from kindergarten and say, there's this weird little kid in my class and he only draws with black crayons. And I talked about him so much, my mother mentioned it to the teacher, and the teacher was flummoxed. She just said, well, that's your son. So I was creating a character for myself early. And my parents were horrified pretty much by my career, but they let me do it. And they realized that I did know what I wanted to be, which is the biggest battle of all for all kids, is you might not be what they want, but at least I knew what I wanted to be. I had a goal. And you go to school to figure out all those years what you want to be. And I knew.
You had clarity.
Yeah, but the school wouldn't let me be who I wanted to be. Today, they might.
Yeah, because you were...
If you pay enough money to pay to get me in. No, I'm just kidding.
Exactly. But you were in a sort of a very preppy...
Well, I was in a very prestigious grade school, which is the only school I really did learn anything in. I learned to public speak. I learned to debate. I learned how to write a letter, a friendly letter, a sympathy letter, and a business letter. But then I went to public junior high, where I learned about trashy girls that I met for the first time, and I used all them in Female Trouble in all my movies. And then I went to Catholic high school, where they discouraged every interest I ever had, where I learned about rage and how to turn that into a screenplay.
My guest is John Waters. His new book is called Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder. Now, you approach writing very much like a job. Like, you get up in the morning and you do your writing and you do your research. And in the book, you talk about things that you had in your book proposal that you had to, you know, you had to honor.
Yeah.
So where did you go to research yourself?
My film archive at Wesleyan University that has every clipping since I was 1964. Thank God they have it. It's the most glamorous storage ever. And I'm in really good company with Clint Eastwood. And I did meet him one time. Mm-hmm. And I said, just think, like, Dirty's Harry's badge will rest next to Divine's cheater.
And then Lin-Manuel's whatever.
Yes, exactly.
Hamilton will be next to that.
So I had to research myself to write about making the later films, because I didn't remember when they came out or what the years were, the grosses and the reviews and all that. And I did a lot of research on other chapters, too. The one about monkey paintings that were a movement that started in the 50s to make fun of abstract expressionism. I took LSD again, which made me really do a lot of research, and especially since I was kind of scared about, you know, that I took acid at 70 degrees. That was 70 years old. That was kind of my stunt of this book, the same way I hitchhiked across America in the last one. Mm-hmm. And I never have to hitchhike again. Now I never have to take acid again.
In the first chapter, you write, "There is a joyous road to ruin out there, and if you let me be your garbage guru, I will teach you how to succeed in insanity and take control of your low self-esteem. Personality disorders are a terrible thing to waste."
Yeah, if you take what you think is probably a disadvantage in your insecurities and everything, and then you start to love them and make fun of them, as long as you can make fun of yourself first, my advice is to only make fun of things you love, not hate. And the tone is very different, and you can get away with it.
So when you started trying to take that idea into art, when do you think you were first successful at that? Taking the odd, the weird, the thing that someone else would think is terrible, turning that, someone would think it was an ick or a yuck, and turning it into a success.
Well, always. I mean, I was a puppeteer with a big part. I had a career when I was 12 years old at children's birthday parties. But because of the influence of William Castle and all his gimmicks on films, I got bored with Punch and Judy, so I put fake blood in it, and the parents would stop hiring me. I was at a camp. I was not the counselor, but a junior counselor, which meant you were half camper and you half worked there. And every night I would read these horror stories that I wrote to the campers, and they would flip out and have nightmares, and the camp called my parents. So it began with that, right in the beginning. And in Mondo Trasho, I think the first movie I ever made, we got arrested. I didn't know we were going to get arrested for conspiracy to commit indecent exposure. So I turned that around and used that, and the American Civil Liberties Union handled our case. It became a national story. Yeah. It wasn't planned, but you use what you got. And I knew enough from reading Variety and knowing about show business about how to embrace that and use it. The publicity was certainly free advertising that I couldn't afford at the time. And still, whenever you do press, it's an even trade, mm-hmm. really, that each is using the other person. So you might as well have fun with it.
It's a handshake.
Yeah.
My guest is John Waters, and the name of his book is Mr. Know-It-All. So what did it mean for you personally? This is a how do you feel question. What did it mean for you personally when you suddenly realized, okay, wait, I'm having mainstream success?
Well, that really happened with Hairspray.
Yeah.
And it kind of happened overnight. And then that went beyond my dreams. It's still beyond my dreams. It's a gift that keeps on giving. I've been hired and paid quite well by Hollywood to write a sequel to the musical, a TV series, and recently by HBO, another sequel that hasn't happened yet. That doesn't mean it's not going to. Plus, they paid me to write them anyway. So that happened, and that surprised me in a way, because I thought all my films would be commercially successful. But not to that. I didn't think they were all going to get turned into musicals, but Hairspray would have been probably the logical choice, even though Hairspray, my movie, was a dance movie. It wasn't an original musical. Crybaby was.
Yeah, yeah, what's the difference between, you say that in the book, that it's a dance movie, not a musical?
Well, because the only original song in it was the title song, Hairspray. All the rest was real music that I love very much, that was obscure to many people, but certainly rhythm and blues music and square music from that era that was used as part of the plot. So Hairspray was not a jukebox musical when it went on stage. It was someone took the idea of that music and wrote, not someone, Scott Whitman and mm-hmm. Mark Shaiman, took the original sound of that music that they knew well and wrote new music to sound like that era. And that's why the music, I think, is so good in it.
Do you have a favorite line from Hairspray?
Which one? My favorite line in the movie is when Divine is watching her daughter on TV for the first time and she starts talking to her and somebody says to her, oh, she can't hear you.
Mine, which I use often when I'm busy. I'm trying to iron in here.
Well, iron, yeah. Like taking in ironing. Do people still do that? That's the thing. I feel bad. I look back. My mother used to take all the ironing to this poor woman who took in ironing, and you go pick it up. And I guess people still take in ironing. I don't know. Or maybe they just wear drip dry clothes or whatever they're called these days.
My guest is John Waters, and we're talking about Mr. Know-It-All. Right now, we're talking about Hairspray, and you write really movingly about Divine's death.
Well, the whole Divine's death in there, which is unfortunately like being in a play that the day Divine died that nobody wanted to be in, if I look back on it. And I'm still shocked Divine is dead, really, because Divine seems more alive today with my movies. People constantly reference him. This Met Ball, I don't think Divine ever got more publicity in his life for someone who wasn't invited. So I think his time was always there, and Divine did know his success before he died. When Hairspray came out, he got great reviews for the first time. Pauline Kael loved him. He got really nice reviews. So it's better than dying the day before it opened, but dying 2 days after, it's much better.
You mentioned this earlier that Crybaby came after, you know, was a little bit more of a traditional.
I guess it was. It was a movie praising juvenile delinquency. But yeah, it when the movie came out, it was not a hit. And the Broadway musical was not a hit either. Mm-hmm. But Crybaby, because of Johnny Depp, I think has probably been seen by more people all over the world than any movie I ever made.
You had this skill of having people do send up versions of themselves. Yeah. You got L7, the punk band, and Joan Rivers, and just Patty Hearst all over the place. What was your pitch to them? How did you talk to them about it?
My pitch to them was that I was never making fun of them at all, that I was fascinated by their life. And Patty Hearst even said to me, people like you, I went to jail. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think they all knew that I was on their side. And I believed in them, and I didn't cast anybody for camp reasons. I didn't ever cast anybody. I thought they were so bad, they were good. I thought they were so good, they were perfect. And so I asked them to do something that they maybe hadn't tried to do, and also to fix their image that they were sick of and hated, like being a famous victim. Who wants to be a famous victim? So if you make fun of that, like Patricia Hearst said, I never would refuse to sign autographs. I was mad when people asked me. But then when she made the movie, she did. Because then she had finally done something, and she had taken something that she never asked for. She was dragged out of her apartment by gunpoint in the trash can and finally let go and had to go to jail. So she was acting the whole time she was with them. That's why she's alive.
That's it. So you actually you gave her a gift in many ways. You
gave
her control
over
her. Well,
she gave me a great gift, too, because she's a good comedian.
It goes back to that sort of that agreement.
Yeah, yeah.
We said camp twice, so I have to bring it up.
Yeah, it's a word I would never say. I'm not even that gay.
The Met Gala. Yeah. It was camp was the theme.
Yeah, which is hard to do because real camp means something is so bad it's good and they don't know it. And it's hard to wear a couture outfit and not know you're wearing it.
This is so funny.
So it's a thin line between trying too hard.
Thin line between trying too hard.
And because real camp was innocence. And it was also a secret word that only gay people knew. And that time has long gone past. And then camp turned to trash, and trash turned to filth. And in Europe, it was always kitsch meant the same thing. So what is camp today when the original, maybe an elderly couple from the 40s that still have a plaster pink flamingos in their front yard is beautiful camp. Hipsters that have it in their front lawn is offensive to me. It's classist.
Will you put on your headphones? Because I want to play a clip for you about camp. And we'll talk about it on the other side.
All right.
$50 for a toy? No kid is worth that.
Oh, but this is the Rex Mars Atomic Discombobulator. Don't you just love the graphics on this box?
No. How can you love a box or a toy or graphics? You're a grown man.
It's camp! The tragically ludicrous? The ludicrously tragic?
Oh, yeah, like when a clown dies.
Well, sort of, but I mean more like inflatable furniture or Last Supper TV trays or even this bowling shirt. Can you believe somebody gave this to Goodwill?
The tragically ludicrous or the ludicrously tragic, they said.
Well, I think that's true, even though I did not write that script. I said the lines that were written for me, and I believe they were correct, and I believe that show is not camp because it was intelligent, I thought, and it was exactly what it was supposed to be. I think it's one of the best Simpsons. Believe me, kids still run up to me in airports and ask me to pick them up. That's camp. Because I say, are you kidding? Look at me. I look like the sex education movie they told you about what perverts look like. I can't pick you up.
My guest is John Waters. The name of his book is Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder. You wrote that Cecil B. Demented is one of your favorite films you've directed. Why?
Well, because you always stick up for the film that maybe didn't do as well as the other one. Like if you have a child with handicaps, you might want to love them even a little bit more. I like the old idea of film terrorism. I try to think today, what would Cecil do today? I mean, he'd go in and yell out rude answers to those horrible quizzes that they have on in the beginning. What does a director mean when he says, action, go, stop, or go the popcorn stand. I hate those things. Or all the movies that are just special effects. Everybody sneaks in and does epicac and like projectile vomits during the big money scene. I think there's still great room for cinema terrorism.
The book has some great lifestyle advice. Can we go through a few things?
Sure.
You offer advice on how to have a good vacation.
Well, you should go to a place you really love that has vacation activities, but you should work a few hours a day. You should never totally be off work, because as soon as you take off work, someone is ready to seize your place.
You write that Prune is your favorite New York City restaurant. That's
a great little
restaurant.
It's a great little restaurant, but they serve food where you can go there and you just get one carrot, one ugly, tough carrot with hair in it, and it tastes delicious.
Now, it's funny that it led you to, in the book, describe what your restaurant would be like.
Called Gristle, the most extreme foodie restaurant. Food we dare you to eat.
And then, wait, I've got to find it. It's on page 178. Your description of it is that there would be... entering Gristle would not be a welcoming experience. You'd be met by an ugly, bewigged, antisocial maitre d' who would explain your table is nowhere near ready and direct you into a bar area that is lit like a hospital emergency room to have a glass of wine he describes as not unlike vinegar from a witch's bleep.
Yeah, I know. Well, that means I get so offended when they go through this, you know, I'm not a wine snob, but when they go through this long ritual, I always want to say, it tastes like it's from a vinegar, from a witch's, just to see their expression. And people that make too big a deal and send the wine back and people that complain all the time, that just meant they had bad parents that didn't teach them manners. If you don't like the restaurant, just don't go there again. It's like you go to the movies. If you don't like it, you don't get to get your money back.
I always think in restaurants, this is the restaurant language that makes me crazy, John. When they're full up, we're committed for the evening.
Committed. Or good choice. Take the bad ones off. Or I'd have this. Well, I'm not taking you to dinner, really.
In your book, you describe yourself as a brat, even at 73, and you still look forward to political trouble.
Yeah, that's being a brat, to look for political trouble when you're in a very comfortable position as I am at this phase of my career. So I do wonder why students are studying today. Why aren't they out on the streets every day? At the same time, the activism thing, I thought it was really going to change when all the smart students walked out, the honor roll. That was really new. It wasn't the bad kids. But then I thought that's why it didn't work, because they needed to remain bad, which meant they had to go to detention. And I want the detention kids to walk out this time and start a really trouble. You know, that would be exciting to me.
Are you interested in politics right
yes.
now?
Oh, very yes. much so. Yeah, yeah. It's very depressing because I think he's going to win again. And I think that what's going to happen now is all the Democrats are going to have to fight each other for the next year, debating issues like, should the Boston bomber be allowed to vote? Are you crazy? Don't debate these things. This is not the main issue right now. They should all team up together, have a secret vote who should run, and stop and let that person so we can win.
My guest is John Waters. The name of his book is Mr. Know-It-All. Are you?
I'll stoop up. You must have some Trump listeners.
Sure.
I get why they all like him, because we hate him, and he's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And he's unrepentant about it. And they love making us angry because we made them feel stupid.
I'm wondering if you're one of the people who believes that in periods like this where times get conservative, or in small areas of the country, people get conservative, great art can sometimes blossom.
I don't know that has that much to do with it. When I go to the galleries now, and I'm a collector of contemporary art, and I see Trump in the art, I think it's not going to last. You're just dating yourself. The only great one I can think of is when Warhol did the McGovern campaign, and it was just a picture of Nixon painted like purple, hideous green. That was a real collector's one that I thought was amazing. But it's hard to do art about politics and not completely date yourself. That's why I don't mention Trump in Mr. Know-It-All, because all my books are still in print. I wanted to stay in print. I don't want to make them just of that period. And I grew up, I lived through Nixon. I lived through Reagan, who I think was just as bad to me because all my friends died of AIDS and he said nothing. So I have radical criticism for all of them. Except Obama, I think, is the best president we ever had. And I know that is heresy. People are going to hear that right now. Their car radios are going to... But I think at the same time that we do have to listen to other people. I know people that Tab Hunter voted for Trump. I know people that did that. I'm always shocked by it. And even my Republican friends say they didn't vote for him. But I'm sure they voted for somebody equally. I don't know if there's anyone equally. But that I wouldn't agree with either. They didn't vote for Hillary. Mm-hmm.
Do you engage your friends who you think possibly voted for Trump? Do you guys engage politically?
To a point. It's like not relatives. When you go home for a vacation, it's just not, you think you might make a joke. And my relatives were smart enough to pretty much figure it out where I stand.
John Waters has been my guest. The name of the book is Mr. Know-It-All. Are you going to make any more movies?
Who knows? I mean, maybe. I still go to meetings about it. I got paid last year to write the sequel to Hairspray for HBO. They didn't make it. Warner Brothers, I've had great luck with it. So maybe. I'm not saying I'm not.
Would it be something new or something you've written already?
Depends.
Is something in the vault?
I had two that are in line. I had the sequel to Hairspray and a children's movie called Fruitcake, about a Christmas movie for children about a very functional family of meat thieves in Baltimore.
Meat thieves in Baltimore.
Yeah, we have that a lot. They knock on your door and go, meat man. You come down and you say, I'll take a pork butt and 2 pounds of ground beef. They shoplift it, bring it back, and you pay half what's on the label.
Did not expect that sentence this morning when I woke up. Meat thieves. John Waters, it's been a pleasure to have you on All
Thank
of It.
Thank you so much.
The name of the book is Mr. Know-It-All. This is All of It on WNYC. Yeah.